Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States and Mrs. Laura Bush.
Hello, everyone. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the White House, Mr. President, members of the Cabinet who are here with us today, members of Congress, Lincoln scholars and enthusiasts, and everyone from Ford's Theater. Thank you very much for joining us today to pay tribute to one of America's greatest presidents and most exemplary men. Ford's Theater is best known as the site of President Lincoln's tragic death, but it was also the site of many happy moments in President Lincoln's life. The theater was Lincoln's refuge from the demands of a wartime White House. It was a favorite venue for indulging his love of the performing arts. Even as a young man, Lincoln memorized passages from Shakespeare. As president, he brought a wide variety of performers to the White House, from a Native American vocalist to a 9-year-old piano prodigy. After the Union's devastating losses at Fredericksburg, President and Mrs. Lincoln, along with members of his cabinet, were buoyed by the antics of P.T. Barnum's Commodore Nutt, a 29-inch-tall singing and dancing circus star who barely reached the president's knee. President Lincoln so loved the performing arts that one night in 1861, as he worked in his office upstairs, he was lured downstairs by the voice of Maida Blanchard, who may have been the first opera singer ever to perform in the Executive Mansion. Miss Blanchard had been serenading guests of Mrs. Lincoln's and was about to depart when the president appeared. Lincoln requested an encore, so the performer sat at the piano and, according to one observer, laid off her shawl from her shoulders that no South would have ever succeeded from. Lincoln apparently agreed. When the president attended her public concert 4 days later at the Willard Hotel, one newspaper noted that Lincoln was wholly absorbed by Blanchard's siren voice. Ford's Theater honors Lincoln by introducing new generation to the performing arts he so loved. The theater treats thousands of young people to their first live dramatic performance. Through museum exhibits and classroom programs, the theater educates American students and international visitors about the circumstances of Lincoln's death and the significance of Lincoln's life. Every year, the Ford Theater bestows its highest honor, the Lincoln Medal, on individuals who exemplify the accomplishments and character of our 16th president. Tonight, we're honoring two people who've upheld Lincoln's ideals of equality and service, Dr. Benjamin Carson and former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Tuesday is the 199th anniversary of Lincoln's birth and the beginning of a 2-year commemoration of his bicentennial. This evening, we'll begin the celebration here at the White House by hearing from distinguished Lincoln scholars, Alan Guelzo and Richard Norton Smith. We'll also be treated to performances by two outstanding Lincoln interpreters, Craig Wallace and Avery Brooks. Now I'd like to present our first Lincoln scholar and speaker, Richard Norton Smith.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Bush, for those kind words and still more for your extraordinary interest in and support of Ford's Theater and all things Lincolnian. In return for your hospitality this evening, I promise to keep in mind Lincoln's cautionary description of a long-winded Springfield warrior whose singular talent it was to compress the most words into the smallest ideas of anyone he knew. With Lincoln himself, of course, exactly the opposite holds true. With a spare eloquence that has never been equaled, he reminded his countrymen, we cannot escape history. The fiery trial through which we pass, will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. A century and a half later, it might be said that we cannot escape Lincoln. In anticipation of his forthcoming bicentennial, a flood of new books has yet to crest. While from Hollywood comes word that Steven Spielberg is about to do for Lincoln what he did earlier for E.T. and Indiana Jones. Then there is the small screen. Having been enlisted in the past to market automobiles and life insurance, our 16th president has more recently teamed up with a smart-mouth beaver to help fight sleep deprivation. Few among his contemporaries could have imagined such a legacy. Case in point. Quote, Mr. Lincoln will go down to posterity as the man who could not read the signs of the time, who plunged his country into a great war without a plan, who failed without excuse, and who fell without a friend. So declared the August London Times in the autumn of 1864. Harsher still were the criticisms directed his way by Lincoln's war-weary countrymen. Asked how it felt to be president in such contentious times, Lincoln compared himself to the man who, having been ridden out of town on a rail, announced, "If it wasn't for the honor of the thing, I'd rather walk." This comes as a surprise to modern-day Americans, many of whom assume that Lincoln was born on Mount Rushmore. How, they ask, could this most polarizing president of his time become, over time, the president against whom all others are measured? Clearly, then, part of the Lincoln legacy is to be wary of anyone, historians included, who presumes to define a president's legacy, at least until sufficient time has passed to allow the cooling of passions and the opening of papers. The presence of Justice O'Connor here this evening reminds us that history, like the law, is a paradoxical discipline, both fixed and evolving, for America is nothing if not a work in progress. Harry Truman might have been thinking of Lincoln when he defined a statesman as a politician who's been dead for 20 years. Pretty shrewd observation for a failed haberdasher. That was one of the milder epithets affixed to the so-called little man from Missouri, of whom it was said, "To err is Truman." Forget NATO and the Marshall Plan, aid to Greece and Turkey, communist containment in Korea, and a desegregated armed forces. When he left office in 1953, Truman took with him some of the lowest popularity ratings ever recorded. For a while, he languished in near obscurity, only to be rediscovered and reassessed against the anguish of Vietnam and the betrayal of Watergate. In an age of focus group convictions, Harry Truman came to be seen as the real deal. Witness his observation, "I wonder how far Moses would have gone if he had taken a poll in Egypt." Above all, Americans came to admire a president who emphatically answered the question, "Does character count?" Three things ruin a man, Truman observed, power, money, and women. I never wanted power, I never had any money, and the only woman in my life is up at the house now. Everyone knows about the sign on Truman's desk asserting the buck stops here. Much less well known is the sign that Dwight Eisenhower kept on his desk. Translated from Latin, it read, "Gently in manner, strongly in deed." Academic critics, accustomed to presidential swashbucklers, dismissed the old soldier as a grandfatherly duffer smiling his way through a bland decade. All that began to change when the first of Ike's White House papers became available in 1966. Soon, students of the presidency were competing in praise of what Princeton's Fred Greenstein calls his hidden hand leadership. So subtle were his methods, so scrambled his syntax, that Murray Kempton, in describing the Eisenhower years, had recourse to the nonsense rhymes of Edward Lear. On the top of the crumpety tree, the quangle wangle sat, but his face you could not see on account of his beaver hat. For his hat was 102 feet wide, with ribbons and bibbons on every side, and bells and buttons and loops and lace, so that nobody ever could see the face of the quangle wangle quee. Innocence, concluded Kempton, was Eisenhower's beaver hat, and the ribbons grew longer and more numerous until his true lines were almost invisible. Half a century later, scholars are still peeking behind Ike's artfully conceived defenses. Revisionism of a different sort is being made possible by the opening of Lyndon Johnson's White House tapes and the publication of Ronald Reagan's correspondence and diaries. There's nothing new about this. Americans have been revising our estimates of presidents for as long as there have been presidents. Quote, "If ever a nation was debauched by a man, the American nation has been debauched by Washington. If ever a nation was deceived by a man, the American nation was deceived by Washington." That's how the Philadelphia Aurora assessed George Washington's legacy in the twilight of the first presidency. His insistence that the United States remain aloof from old world quarrels brought savage criticism of the aging hero whose judgment and even patriotism were called into question. Posterity, needless to say, has been kinder in its estimate. At the height of the debunking craze of the 1920s, Calvin Coolidge was asked if Washington's historical standing had been permanently diminished. Coolidge went to the window of his White House study, pulled back a drape, and pointed in the direction of the nearby mall. "I see his monument is still there," he said. That brilliant simplifier, Theodore Roosevelt, liked to divide presidents into two categories, Lincoln types and Buchanan types. Like his distant cousin Franklin, T.R. understood the essential truth of democratic leadership, that there can be no authority without moral authority. Washington possessed it as if by divine right. Jefferson earned it through his pen, Andrew Jackson with his sword, Lincoln through his mystical attachment to Union, T.R. because he was born to pound a pulpit. The monuments on the mall celebrate this truth and the leaders who embody it, each of whom enlarged American democracy, each of whom was willing to accept short-term unpopularity in defense of long-term interests. In this, they are hardly alone. In averting war with France, John Adams split his party and cost himself a second term. In purchasing Louisiana from the French, Thomas Jefferson sacrificed ideological purity to the national interest. Woodrow Wilson destroyed his health in preaching the gospel of collective peacekeeping and a League of Nations. Next to the peacemakers, blessed are the risk takers, if their risks are taken in the name of principles that outlive any administration. Certainly John Kennedy took a risk when he blockaded Cuba and humanity clung to the narrow window wedge of nuclear standoff. Lyndon Johnson took a risk standing before a joint session of Congress declaring we shall overcome. Richard Nixon took a risk when he went to China, Jimmy Carter when he brokered the Camp David Accords, Ronald Reagan when he refused to surrender his strategic defense initiative in the face of Soviet bluster. When the Berlin Wall came down, George H.W. Bush took a risk by not going to Berlin for the ultimate photo op. Too much the gentleman to humiliate Mikhail Gorbachev, President Bush's self-denying act paid off when Gorbachev supported the ouster of Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. And Bill Clinton took a risk when he defied important elements within his own party to enact the free trade policies of NAFTA. And then there was the president who went out of his way to proclaim himself with Truman-like modesty, a Ford, not a Lincoln. Talk about grounded. On the night he was sworn into office, Gerald Ford and his family returned to their Alexandria home. From the kitchen, Betty Ford called out to her husband, "Jerry, there's something wrong with this picture. You're president of the United States, and I'm still cooking." It was characteristic of Ford that when faced with the most critical decision of his young presidency, he didn't take a poll, he said a prayer. The streets around this White House were deserted early in the morning of September 8, 1974, when Ford slipped across Lafayette Square to take communion at St. John's Church. Returning to the Oval Office, he signed the document immunizing his predecessor from prosecution for any Watergate-related offenses. He also accepted the resignation of his White House press secretary. The Nixon pardon unleashed a storm of anger, reminiscent of the calls for impeachment touched off by Harry Truman's decision a quarter century earlier to fire General Douglas MacArthur. "I fired MacArthur," said Truman, "because he wouldn't respect the authority of the president. I didn't fire him because he was a dumb son of a bitch." Although he was. Overnight, Ford's approval ratings dropped a record 22 points. His friend Tip O'Neill told him the pardon would cost him the 1976 election. Perhaps it did. Yet time has been generous to Gerald Ford. Long before he died, he had the quiet satisfaction of knowing that most of his countrymen had come to rethink their immediate reaction to the pardon. Even among those who disagreed with his action, few questioned his motives. 30 years later, his legacy as a presidential healer seemed secure. At a particularly dark moment in his own fiery trial, Abraham Lincoln told us, "The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion." I can think of no better yardstick with which to measure a president's legacy. And so we ask ourselves, generation after generation, did he rise to the occasion, to the difficulties as well as the opportunities that defined his years in office? Did the force of his personality and the power of his ideas affect the way Americans live, how they see themselves, how they relate to each other, and to the rest of the world? Did he spend himself in causes larger than himself, for purposes nobler than the Gallup poll? Did he make a significant difference, not just in his time, but for a long time to come? For if Lincoln teaches us anything, it is this: that leaders who uphold timeless principles, whatever price they may pay in the moment, will generally find that time is on their side. No part of the Lincoln legacy is more important than the document he signed in this house on the first day of January, 1863. Now, to share parts of it with us is a distinguished actor, well known to Washington audiences, Mr. Craig Wallace.
By the President of the United States of America, a proclamation that on the first day of January, in the year of our Lord 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or designated part of a state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall be then, thenceforward, and forever free. And the executive government of the United States, including the military and naval authority thereof, will recognize and maintain the freedom of such persons and will do no act or acts to repress such persons or any of them in any efforts they may make for their actual freedom. And I hereby enjoin the people so declared to be free to abstain from all violence unless in necessary self-defense. And I recommend to them that, in all cases when allowed, they labor faithfully for reasonable wages. And I further declare and make known that such persons of suitable condition will be received into the armed service of the United States to garrison forts, positions, stations, and other places, and to man vessels of all sorts in said service. And upon this act, sincerely believed to be an act of justice warranted by the Constitution upon military necessity, I invoke the considerate judgment of mankind and the gracious favor of Almighty God, in witness whereof I have hereunto set my hand and caused the seal of the United States to be affixed. Abraham Lincoln. Now, award-winning historian and author Dr. Allen Gelzo will present his piece, The Road to Emancipation, with Avery Brooks, star of stage and screen, reading the words of Abraham Lincoln.
All through his life, said Abraham Lincoln in 1854,
I have always hated slavery.
He said it again in 1858, and in 1864, he wrote it out for a Kentucky newspaper editor to publish.
I am naturally anti-slavery. If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. I cannot remember when I did not so think and feel.
He told his friend, Joseph Gillespie,
that slavery was a great and crying injustice, an enormous national crime, and that we could not expect to escape punishment for it.
Abraham Lincoln hated slavery because he saw it as a contradiction of the most basic principles of liberty on which the American Republic was founded.
Most governments have been based practically on the denial of equal rights of men. Ours began by affirming those rights. We proposed to give all a chance, and we expected the weak to grow stronger, the ignorant wiser, and all better and happier together. But now, our Republican robe is soiled and trailed in the dust. Slavery has become the one retrograde institution in America. It is undermining the principles of progress and fatally violating the noblest political system the world ever saw.
He hated slavery again because it made working men ashamed of laboring with their hands, because that was slave work.
Its ownership betokened not only the possession of wealth, but indicated the gentleman of leisure who was above and scorned labor.
He hated slavery again because it violated the natural rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness which every creature had hardwired into their nature by their creator.
The ant, who has toiled and dragged a crumb to his nest, will furiously defend the fruit of his labor against whatsoever robber assails him. So plain that the most dumb and stupid slave that ever toiled for a master does constantly know that he is wronged. So plain that no one, high or low, ever does mistake it except in a plainly selfish way. For although volume upon volume is written to prove slavery a very good thing, we never hear of the man who wishes to take the good of it by being a slave himself.
And he hated slavery because it turned decent men into hypocrites, as they tried to explain why, in a nation of liberty, 4 million of its people could be held in forced labor merely because of their race.
By descending from the high Republican faith of our ancestors, we were proclaiming ourselves political hypocrites before the world. By thus fostering human slavery, and proclaiming ourselves at the same time the sole friends of human freedom.
Just the simple sight of slavery made Lincoln turn away in misery.
I hate to see the poor creatures hunted down and caught and carried back to their stripes and unrewarded toils.
He told his old friend Joshua Speed.
In 1841, you and I had together a tedious low water trip on a steamboat from Louisville to St. Louis. You may remember, as I well do, that from Louisville to the mouth of the Ohio, there were on board 10 or 12 slaves shackled together with irons. That sight was a continual torment to me, and I see something like that every time I touch the Ohio or any other slave border.
But was there a solution? On the day Abraham Lincoln won his first and only election to Congress, slavery was protected by state law in the 15 southern states of the Union and in the District of Columbia, where black men, women, and children were auctioned off within sight of the Capitol. No federal law under the Constitution could reach across the wall that separated federal and state governments to lay a finger on slavery, and no amount of persuasion had ever succeeded in moving the southern states to end slavery themselves.
The autocrat of all the Russias will resign his crown and proclaim his subjects free republicans sooner than when all American masters voluntarily give up their slaves.
The northern states had long since put an end to slavery there, but not to the racial hatred of whites in the North for blacks, and so there was not much hope that the northern states would do anything to free the slaves either.
The great mass of white people will not free them and make them politically and socially our equals.
And yet, how could the American Republic go on into the future half slave and half free?
Our political problem now is, can we, as a nation, continue together permanently, forever, half slave and half free? The problem is too mighty for me. May God, in his mercy, superintend the solution.
There were some Northerners, white and black, who thought the solution lay in the immediate abolition of slavery, no matter what it took, politically or otherwise. And if they did not get abolition at once, they were prepared to call for the dissolution of the American Union, tearing up the Constitution, even staging bloody slave uprisings. The most violent of the abolitionists, John Brown, tried to incite an uprising among slaves in Virginia in 1859, seizing the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry in order to supply his followers with weapons. These abolitionists, Lincoln warned, wanted to take the wrong path to the right goal. And by taking the wrong path, guarantee that the right goal would never be reached.
Those who would shiver into fragments the union of these states, tear to tatters its now venerated Constitution, and even burn the last copy of the Bible, rather than slavery should continue a single hour, have received and are now receiving their just execration.
The best path, argued Lincoln, was to hem slavery into the states where it was then legal, admit no further slave states to the Union, and allow slavery to run out of air.
I believe that whenever the effort to spread slavery into the new territories by whatever means and into the free states themselves shall fairly be headed off, the institution will then be in course of ultimate extinction.
But Lincoln balked just as strongly at slaveholders who demanded that slavery be legalized everywhere in the United States, and who tore up the Declaration of Independence because they could not bear to see Thomas Jefferson's proclamation that all men are created equal, held up as the national standard.
I have never had a feeling politically that did not spring from the sentiments embodied in the Declaration of Independence. Once, our Declaration of Independence was held sacred by all and thought to include all. But now, to aid in making the bondage of the Negro universal and eternal, it is assailed and sneered at and construed and hawked at and torn till, if its framers could rise from their graves, they could not at all recognize it.
And the price to be paid for tearing it up, sooner or later, would be
a resumption of tyranny in our fair land.
What made and kept Americans free was not
our frowning battlements, our bristling seacoasts, the guns of our war steamers, or the strength of our gallant and disciplined army. Our reliance is in the love of liberty, which God has planted in our bosoms. Our defense is in the preservation of the spirit, which prizes liberty as the heritage of all men, in all lands, everywhere. Destroy this spirit, and you have planted the seeds of despotism around your own doors.
John Brown tried his solution to slavery in 1859 and failed. In 1860, it was the turn of Southern slaveholders to attempt theirs by breaking up the Union. Abraham Lincoln was elected as the first anti-slavery president of the United States in that year, and Southerners convinced themselves that he intended to do nothing less than abolish slavery. Rather than try Lincoln at his word, they announced their secession from the Union to form a new slave republic, the Confederate States of America, and civil war broke out between North and South. Abolitionists begged him to use the war as a pretext for declaring the South's slaves free. But even as President of the United States, he had no constitutional authority to undo state laws about slavery. And if he tried, his decree would surely end up in the federal courts, where it was clear that any action he took against slavery would be struck down as unconstitutional. But if Lincoln had no direct strategy for dealing with slavery, he had two indirect strategies. One was to offer the slave-holding states a federally financed buyout with government bonds offered to state legislatures and the legislatures using the sale of the bonds to buy up their state slaves. Yes, this would be expensive, but not as expensive as civil war.
In the mere financial or pecuniary view, any member of Congress with the census tables and the treasury reports before him can readily see for himself how very soon the current expenditures of this war would purchase at fair valuation all the slaves in any named state.
But the four slave states which had remained loyal to the Union, Delaware, Missouri, Maryland, and Kentucky, which Lincoln hoped would be a test case for his buyout plan, threw the plan back in his face. That left Lincoln only one other strategy, and it was the most risky of all, a proclamation of emancipation, freeing the slaves and issued not in his civilian authority as president, but, since a war was on, in his military capacity as commander-in-chief, using the presidential war powers. No president had ever before attempted to use these war powers in a national conflict. No one, in fact, had ever tested the meaning of the Constitution's words about the president being the commander-in-chief in time of war. But the Civil War was going badly. Union armies were slumping in retreat. The time and the opportunity to act against slavery was slipping away, and Lincoln
had about come to the conclusion that it was a military necessity absolutely essential to the salvation of the Union, that we must free the slaves or be ourselves subdued.
On July 22nd, 1862, he informed a special meeting of the cabinet that
I had resolved upon the adoption of the emancipation policy.
And he read to them from two sheets of paper the first draft of an emancipation proclamation.
As a fit and necessary military measure for effecting this object, I, as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States, do order and declare that on the first day of January, in the year of our Lord, 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or states wherein the constitutional authority of the United States shall not then be practically recognized, submitted to, and maintained, shall then, thenceforward, and forever be free.
The only objection came from the Secretary of State, William Seward, who asked Lincoln to wait on issuing the proclamation until the Union armies had won a victory on the battlefield, so that Lincoln could appear to be dealing from strength, not desperation. This made sense to Lincoln, who laid the document, but not his intentions, away.
I put the draft of the proclamation aside, waiting for a victory.
But Union forces reeled from still more defeats, and a Confederate army under Robert E. Lee actually crossed the Potomac and threatened Washington. Lincoln now had no other recourse.
When Lee came over the river, I made a solemn vow before God that if General Lee was driven back, I would crown the result by the declaration of freedom to the slaves.
And then the victory came at Antietam Creek in western Maryland on September 17th, 1862.
I could not find out till Saturday, September 20th, whether we really won a victory or not.
But once the news was sure, so was the next step. He convened the cabinet on Monday, September 22nd, 1862, telling them that so long as the Confederate invasion was underway,
I said nothing to anyone, but I made the promise to myself and to my Maker. The rebel army is now driven out, and I am going to fulfill that promise. God had decided this question. in favor of the slaves.
The Confederate states would have 100 days to consider and surrender. If they did not, on January 1st, the Emancipation Proclamation would become law. Or at least it would become military law. And depending on what the courts might do, it would remain law only so long as the war lasted and Lincoln had armies to enforce it. What might happen beyond that was anybody's guess. As he told the Kentucky politician, Duff Green,
"I cannot recall my proclamations. Whether they are binding or not will be a question for the courts."
Still, Lincoln would never back away from the Emancipation Proclamation.
"I know very well that the name which is connected with this act will never be forgotten. It is my greatest and most enduring contribution to the history of the war. It is, in fact, the central act of my administration and the great event of the 19th century."
And if Congress or the courts demanded he cancel it, he would prefer to resign the presidency.
"While I remain in my present position, I shall not attempt to retract or modify the Emancipation Proclamation, nor shall I return to slavery any person who is free by the terms of that proclamation. Even if the Northern people should rise up and by whatever mode or means make it an executive duty to re-enslave such persons, another, and not I, must be their instrument to perform it."
To recant the Emancipation Proclamation meant that
"I should be damned in time and in eternity for so doing."
The 1st of January, 1863, came clear and cold, and all through the late morning and early afternoon, a steady stream of guests came calling at the White House for the traditional presidential New Year's reception. Lincoln shook hands until his forearm ached and until the crowds finally left, and then walked upstairs to his office where Secretary of State Seward waited with the official copy of the proclamation for Lincoln to sign. He had made only a few small changes to the version read to the cabinet, but one of them was the addition of a sentence which touched on the vow that stood behind the proclamation.
"Upon this act, sincerely believed to be an act of justice, warranted by the Constitution upon military necessity, I invoke the considerate judgment of mankind and the gracious favor of Almighty God."
However, when he sat down to sign the state copy,
"I could not for a moment control my arm. I paused, and a superstitious feeling came over me which made me hesitate."
But then he remembered that
"I had been shaking hands for hours with several hundred people. I never in my life felt more certain that what I was doing was right than I do in signing this paper."
He signed it slowly and deliberately, and as he so rarely did, with his full name,
"Abraham Lincoln."
He looked up and remarked quietly,
"That will do."
This would not be the end of the story of emancipation for Abraham Lincoln. There was still a war to win, and an amendment to the Constitution which would put the freeing of the slaves beyond the reach of both courts and critics. Nor has the story ever really ended. The liberty that Jefferson and Lincoln saw written by nature and nature's God in every human heart is still the desire of the nations. We as Americans still walk the emancipation road that Lincoln trod. And his vow still kindles the sacred principles of liberty in our hearts.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Rex Tillerson.
Mr. President, Mrs. Bush, members of Cabinet, members of the Congress, honored guests, ladies and gentlemen, it is indeed my honor to join you this evening in commemorating one of our nation's great presidents. When Abraham Lincoln's life ended in tragedy 73 years ago, he left a rich legacy of leadership, as Richard Norton Smith, Craig Wallace, Alan Gelzo, and Avery Brooks reminded us this evening. Preserving and promoting this legacy is the mission of Forge Theater Society, on whose board I am privileged to serve. Working in close partnership with the National Park Service and the District of Columbia, we have begun a multi-million dollar effort to restore and expand Forge Theater and Museum. Work is currently underway, and 1 year from now, when we celebrate the bicentennial of Lincoln's birth, the first phase will be completed and the doors of the theater reopened. And when the entire project is completed, including construction of the new Center for Education and Leadership, the Forge Theater campus on 10th Street will become an important destination for Americans of all ages to learn and experience Lincoln's legacy. At the dedication of the cemetery at Gettysburg, Lincoln showed how a place of sorrow can become a source of inspiration, how, in his immortal words, "From these honored dead, we take increased devotion to the cause for which they here gave the last full measure of devotion." At Forge Theater, where Lincoln himself ended his last full measure of devotion, we are transforming a place of sorrow into a living landmark for new generations of Americans to draw inspiration. Many are supporting this historic effort. On behalf of Forge Theater Society, I want to thank the President, Secretary Kemp Thorne, and the administration for their help. And I especially want to thank the First Lady for her tremendous time and effort that she has dedicated to Forge Theater as well. All Americans are heirs of Lincoln's legacy. It is up to us to preserve and uphold it for our heirs as well. Thank you.
Welcome. Lauren, I'm glad you're here. Rex, thank you for taking the lead for Forge Theater. If any citizen wants to know how to make a solid contribution to Washington, D.C., support Forge Theater. It's worth it. Members of my cabinet, thanks for coming. Members of Congress, we're glad you're here. I've got two tasks. One is to present the Lincoln Medal and invite you to a buffet. I really want to thank Richard for coming. I appreciate your words, Alan. Thank you very much. And Craig Wallace. Avery, I've been subject to a few presidential impersonations myself. I'm confident Abe would have liked it. I really appreciate you all coming. It's made this a very special evening. I do want to welcome all the Lincoln scholars here and all the Lincoln enthusiasts. We're really glad you're here. I also am amazed that 200 years have gone by. It just, it just doesn't seem all that long ago, does it? But it's fitting that we honor Abe Lincoln. He, of all the successors to George Washington, none had greater impact on the presidency and on the country. And he remains a presence here in the House. I'm often asked, do you ever see Lincoln's ghost? And I'll tell people I quit drinking 22 years ago. But his office is directly above us. At the center hall, there's a likeness in marble. His portrait hangs in the Oval Office. And there's a fabulous portrait of Abe Lincoln in the state dining room. And that's the way it should be. He was a fabulous man and a great president. His life was one of humble beginnings and steadfast convictions. And so we celebrate his deeds, we lift up his ideals, and we honor this good man. And it's my pleasure tonight to honor two really fine Americans. Each year, Ford Theater presents the Lincoln Medal to recognize high achievement and personal attributes that embody the character of the 16th president. Dr. Ben Carson is the director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. He is one of the most respected surgeons in the world. 20 years ago, when a 70-member surgical team made history and separated a pair of Siamese twins, the gifted hands leading the team belonged to this good man. Raised with his brother and his single mother, who's here, Ben Carson didn't get much handed to him as he grew up. But his mother pushed him to learn and taught him to trust in the ways of heaven. From his days at Yale and the University of Michigan Medical School, colleagues have known Dr. Carson as both a skilled professional and a deeply reflective man. His many current duties include service on the President's Council on Bioethics and a tireless commitment to helping young people find direction and motivation in life. He reminds them that all of us have gifts by the grace of the Almighty God. He tells them to think big, to study hard, and to put character first. He tells them to be nice, because in his words, if you're nice to people, then once they get over the suspicion of why you're being nice, they will be nice to you. His example gives eloquent testimony to the value of perseverance and to the endless promise of America. So tonight we proudly honor Dr. Ben Carson. President Ronald Reagan called Sandra Day O'Connor a person for all seasons, and few Americans have shown a broader range of talent. She is, after all, the only Supreme Court justice ever inducted into the Cowgirl Hall of Fame. Born in El Paso, Texas, she spent much of her childhood on a ranch in Arizona, where from a young age she learned to ride horses, mend fences, and shoot a rifle. She was an academic star attending Stanford Law School. It's a different era when she got out of law school. After all, not many law firms wanted to hire a woman. But with her intellect, independent spirit, and sense of adventure, Sandra Day O'Connor continued a steady rise in the world. She became a state senator, state court judge, and the first woman on the highest court in the land. For 24 years, Justice O'Connor stood out as a careful, fair-minded jurist. Sandra Day O'Connor is a great mom to her three sons, and she has been a blessing to her husband, John. This lovely lady remains one of the most admired women of our time. She's lived a great American life, and our nation is proud to honor you once again, Justice. Welcome.